Ladies and gentlemen, coming soon, a podcast you've all been waiting for. The movie podcast to end all movie podcasts. A podcast that discusses and critiques the best of the best and the worst of the worst movies playing at a theater near you. With a host whose opinions have been deemed as fact by your favorite fact checkers. And that's a fact. Without further ado, let me introduce you to the movie maestro, the tyrant of theater, the gumshoe of review, the man that makes theater employees and Hollywood execs shiver by his mere presence. Ladies and gentlemen, the judge, the jury, the sultan of cinema, Justin Henson! Welcome to the Movie Wire.
Welcome to this week's edition of The Movie Wire. I'm your host, Justin Henson, and welcome to the show. We have a big show this week with four brand new reviews, which are all now playing in theaters. This week on the show, children can be such monsters in the new vampire film, Abigail. When you box yourself into a corner, kill your way out in Boy Kills World. Your biggest fear just got bigger in Sting. And finally, the British military recruits a small group of highly skilled soldiers to strike against German forces behind enemy lines during World War II in Guy Ritchie's A Ministry of Ungentlemanly Warfare. We've got a lot to cover this week, so let's jump right in. Ready for my verdict? Let's get into it.
Just out of the windows to watch a roar and a burst of flame.
The Movie Wire Podcast.
There it is.
You need people like me.
The podcast
for hot and trendy
movies.
The Wire.
And here we go.
A fever dream action film that follows Boy, a deaf person with a vibrant imagination. When his family is murdered, he is trained by a mysterious shaman to repress his childhood imagination and become an instrument of death in the new ridiculous action film, Boy Kills World.
Let's do this. This was never a great city, but it was ours.
Are you with me? Always.
Until Hilda Vanderkoy took it from us. This is how she keeps control. They call it the Calling.
They're all gonna watch and cheer as you die.
That's me, facing televised execution by breakfast cereal mascots. Not my happiest day. But let me take you back to an even worse one. The day the Vanderkoys killed my family and left me deaf and mute. So, I made a three-step plan. Step one, give myself an inner voice. I took the last one I remembered from this video game. Player one wins! Step two, get stronger. A lot stronger. And step three, join a team.
Welcome to the Resistance.
Yeah, go team. The mission is simple. Make the Vanderkoys pay for what they have done. Insert crazy action montage.
You fall in love. Is caving in. You never been so nuts about a guy. You wanna laugh.
Here comes the hopper.
You know how hard it is to get a cereal company to sponsor mass murder?
Wow.
You ring the bell.
Plan time!
I don't like this plan.
You have reached your final destination.
I have information. I'm gonna help you.
Probably wasn't gonna help us.
Definitely sounded like he was gonna help us.
Now, I have no experience in drugs, but if cocaine and using bath salts at the same time was a movie, this would be it. Boy Kills World is the most mentally annoying annoying, mentally exhausting, mind-numbing cinematic experience I have witnessed to date. It brought me back to when we had that huge spike of 3D movies in theaters. How halfway through I had to take my 3D glasses off to give my eyes a break. I had the same experience with Boy Kills World, only Boy Kills World wasn't 3D. It felt like director Moritz Moore was having a seizure while directing and editor Lucien Bernard was having a stroke during production. Even though I did walk out of Boy Kills World with a headache, I also walked out with a smile. Sitting through Boy Kills World is a hard movie to explain. There's no rhyme or reason for me to like it if I just looked at it at face value. And this picture moves so quick it really doesn't give me time to even blink. But as Boy Kills World takes me on a hyperactive ride, the last couple of minutes unlocks something in me and I just understood it. Some will get it, some won't, some might not even piece it together right away, and some just won't relate, and that's okay, and that's what's gonna make this movie an either you love it or you hate it kind of movie. This is the type of movie that knows it's going to split audiences down the middle, because the filmmakers have a vision of style, theme, and love that they want to put on the big screen. As the movie came to a close and I was finally able to take a breath and blink an eye, I realized I felt the same way as playing a video game in the 80s and 90s. Where I would spend hours trying to beat a certain level, beat a certain game, or a certain boss. And when I did, I just stared at the screen with disbelief. That was my exact reaction when I saw the credits pop up. Now, I don't know if staring at a screen of disbelief is a good thing with a movie, but this movie did unlock something after it closed. I was also joined by a special guest during this screening, which was my wife. This is the first screening that she's attended with me, and actually the first movie in over 2 years she's attended with me. She was smiling and laughing as she just got off of a roller coaster. After seeing her reaction and the way I felt with the adrenaline rushing, I then realized that the filmmakers here had a mission, and it was mission accomplished. Boy Kills World leans heavy on the video game themes and wants to ensure that the audience doesn't just feel it, but rather get hypnotized, especially by the extremely seizure-enticing editing. And of course, the non-stop action. When you have video games and you have action, you also have to have one-liners, which include our main character, Boy, played by Bill Skarsgård, who is a mute and can't hear, but does hear his inner thoughts voiced by Bob of Bob's Burgers, H. John Benjamin, who yells out,
"Player One wins."
After decapitating someone. The film was directed by new director Moritz Moore in his first big movie, which a lot of the style and hyperactivity in this movie may not be intentional coming from a new director, but meh. I'm not gonna assume anything. Whatever it is, it did the job it sought out to do. It's the ride you get from the beginning to the end and everything in the middle that counts. Boy Kills World was written by a writer for who must have been the real inspiration for this movie, and that's Tyler Burton Smith, who wrote so far the unreleased follow-up to the short, Kung Fury, in Kung Fury 2, and the 2019 Child's Play remake. Alongside Smith, we have Arend Remmers and our director, Moritz Moore, who also helped write. My first thought is, why in the hell did this movie have so many writers? For a movie where the director must have just appeared on set and instead of yelling action, he yelled,
"Ready, fight!"
But I can see a lot of similarities and inspiration from the original Kung Fury film, and since the second Kung Fury has been in film purgatory for years, this must have been Tyler Burton Smith's quest to have his vision be told, just kind of in a different story. Now, at the end of the day, when the credits finish and the lights go up, it's about your first reactions, your first feelings, and the questions that linger. Was it entertaining? Did it change or influence you? Did it affect you emotionally? These are questions I ask myself when I watch a film, and if I can't give an answer to why, then I go into rewatches. And honestly, I don't know why I liked Boy Kills World. I can't explain it, but I don't think I can mentally stand to watch it again. I remember taking a trip to Disneyland with my family years ago, and the only ride I was really excited for was the Guardians of the Galaxy ride, where the ride consists of lifting you up to the top of a building and then dropping you, with 80s music blasting in the background. I went, I rode, I experienced it. I can now say that I did it, and I liked it. But I didn't have a desire to hop back in line again to write it again. I said the same thing about Boy Kills World. It's a complete theme park ride. There's nothing to analyze here. There's no real point. Even though in the final moments, it tries to have a single moment to justify itself, but all it is an exclamation mark to end the movie, not a symbolic point. It's a reminder that this was merely a movie to give homage to the love of action and video games. Boy Kills World will most likely give some a seizure for how fast it goes. It's ludicrous, it's ridiculous, it has more camera movement and editing than the Handycam in the Blair Witch Project. It made me want to reach out to the editor of this movie and ask, are you okay? Or have somebody at least do a wellness check after working on this movie. If you're expecting something of substance going into this movie, you're not going to get that here. If you're expecting a fast-paced action flick with absolutely no point, then in the words of Samuel L. Jackson,
hold on to your butts.
Now, let me be very clear here as I wrap up this review. There is no rhyme or reason this movie deserves this rating, but damn, it was a unique ride. And for that, I'm giving Boy Kills World 3 stars. After a group of criminals kidnap the ballerina daughter of a powerful underworld figure, they retreat to an isolated mansion. Unaware, they're locked inside with no normal little girl in Abigail.
You all came highly recommended. You know the rules. No real names, no backstories, no cell phones.
So whose kid is she?
A very wealthy man who's about to be $50 million poorer.
I'm here to make sure you're safe.
What's your name? Mine's Abigail.
You can call me Joey.
Do you have any kids?
I have a little boy.
See you in 24 hours.
Do you know what a pinky promise is? If you behave and do as we say, like pinky promise you, it'll all be over soon.
Joey?
Yeah?
I'm sorry about what's gonna happen to you.
What the fuck?
We gotta get out of here.
I think she knows something.
Guys?
Guys? Guys!
Oh, no!
What the fuck is that thing?
We kidnapped a fucking vampire. A ballerina vampire. Okay. How do we kill a vampire? What are we talking about? Like an Anne Rice or a True Blood? You know, Twilight? Stake through the heart. Daylight is a big one.
All right, let's go kill us a fucking vampire. Ready?
Okay, it's a vampire movie. In the 102 years of vampires in film, what more can we expect from a movie like this? We've seen vampires in almost every situation. We've seen it all before. It's predictable, it's bloody, it has no point. These are just a sample of the numerous things going through my head as I sat down to Abigail waiting for the movie to start. But there is one thing I haven't seen before in a vampire film, and that's a little girl that sports a ballerina dress that transforms into a vampire to a bunch of kidnappers. And I guess that's better than Dracula in space. I think Hollywood has finally found its new niche to try and attempt to make a character feel fresh again. Let's put a tutu on it. Jason in a tutu, Freddy in a tutu, Chucky in a tutu, Nicolas Cage in a tutu, because the tutu is now a gimmick. This little girl in a tutu is the hook to pull people into this repetitive story, this repetitive character. But here's the thing. The writing and direction here actually does something with this, instead of just leaving it at a mere premise or a mere hook. The mere presence of the dead stare, the snarling of our character Abigail, hit close to home for me. It reminded me of when my daughter gets home from school looking for a snack.
Dad, stop!
It's terrifying!
You're not gonna put that in there, are you?
Now, over the months, I have seen countless trailers of Abigail play before many of the movies I've reviewed, and I really thought I had this movie pegged. I thought to myself, it's gonna be another bloodfest that the trailer shows everything you need to know about it. It's showing all the main twists and turns, just showing pivotal scenes, to the point I thought I was going to be bored watching it at a runtime that runs longer than I would have expected at an hour and 50 minutes. Usually we get these kinds of movies that run around the 90-minute mark, and most seem to really try and stretch that 90-minute mark. After the countless times of watching this trailer, I kept thinking to myself, without even watching the movie, that I hate it when trailers do this to movies, because I was assuming what this movie was. Abigail absolutely took me by surprise that it had a lot of tricks up its sleeve than what was shown in the trailer. It was so confident in itself that it was very strategic on what it showed the audience. The trailer was very strategic on what it placed to kind of throw the viewer off, because I was taken by surprise in how many twists and turns this movie actually had. It's a mix of 2019's Ready or Not, Buffy the Vampire Slayer, and the banter of 1998's The Big Hit. I was completely taken back and surprised that this will not only just appease fans of its genre, but also give them something that we haven't seen in a vampire movie in years, which is a movie that wastes no time to dive into the suspense, but also uses its pacing to its advantage. Abigail is very smart to not give the viewer any time to think about what's going to happen next. We get typical dumb decisions from our characters throughout the movie. We get our characters splitting up, we get our characters placed in the creepiest places of the house that they're all trapped in. But the smart writing of the characters and direction keeps us on our toes. We expect our ballerina vampire to jump out almost every time at every turn. We see it coming most of the time. But I found myself worried what these characters are going to do. The smart direction and character writing is what gives Abigail its true forte. It's a movie that balances entertainment, fun, and twists and turns to an expert level. Even to the point where I counted three different placements where this movie could have ended, and the movie throws in twists and different character interactions that didn't make me look at my watch, but rather say, show me more. This is the prime example of the way trailers should be. Give out the hook to bring people in and give them what they want, but then give the twist of adding something unexpected. There was a brief shot in the third act where it may have lasted roughly about 30 seconds, where my mind said, here we go. This is where the movie is going to lose steam. Here we get a classic shot of mere nothingness, but a shadowy hallway, as we get from some directors that don't know where to transition or where to go with the material. It's just kind of a useless shot. And this 30 seconds out of the hour and 50 minute runtime was the only part of the movie I can say that didn't entertain me. The pacing here in Abigail, it's brisk, it's fast, it never slows down, and it never feels dull. And this is the way a movie like this should be. A roller coaster where we can hear the tick, tick, tick of the roller coaster it goes up. We can anticipate, we know what's going to happen, and right when it reaches the peak, it shoots us in multiple directions that we know is going to be tense and it's going to be fun, but we don't know how it's going to get us there. Abigail was written by new writer Stephen Shields and Guy Buzek from Ready or Not in 2022 Scream and Scream 6. We see a good mix here and reminders of Buzek's work, especially from Ready or Not. And this is a good example of the understanding of the written material and executed vision by directors Matt Battaglia-Open and Tyler Gillett, who also directed Ready or Not, Scream, and Scream 6. Between the writing and directing, the fun factor is always present. The characters are always simplistic, but brilliantly simplistically likable or likable to hate. There is an energy of just not individual performances, but the chemistry as an ensemble is more likable than it has any right to be, given that these are strangers that don't even know each other's first names. And again, we go back to the writers. This is due to the written dialogue that envisions itself almost as a one-set movie scene that has to be dialogue-driven, and it has to rely on what the cast does with the dialogue and how they energize each other. It's almost like a B-movie 12 Angry Men, but with a vampire ballerina. The cast here is especially good, including the overacted cartoonist Dan Stevens, who plays Frank, one of the characters we love to hate. But when we see him on screen, he is so over the top, we can't help but have a good time. Now, our main character, our ballerina vampire Abigail, played almost way too good by Alicia Weir, who plays a completely opposite character that we saw her in the Netflix exclusive Matilda the Musical. Weir gives it her all in this, and as I just said, it's way too good than it needs to be. It's an unsettling performance, and with how good she is in playing Matilda, this actually was a smart role choice to really challenge her range. Even when Weir delivers some cheesy, unavoidable lines, such as the line, "I like to play with my food," I gave out a nervous, awkward chuckle. Her performance is brilliantly accompanied by, and I'm gonna say a naughty word in Hollywood, ready for it? Accompanied by completely practical effects by Martin Fitzpatrick and makeup by Liz Byrne, Hannah Sullivan, and Amy Plant. And I have to give a mention to the one that did the dental prosthetics here because they were a standout of absolute creepiness, and that was Dominic Mumbrun. I can tell that Alicia Weir practiced her visual facial expressions in the mirror because every look our Abigail character gives is utter perfection. It's planned, it's strategic. We can tell there's a lot of planning, a lot of work that went into these looks. The looks by themselves are utterly unsettling. If we had that up-close shot of Abigail, I was squirming in my seat. And this adds to Abigail's forte, which is balancing the fun factor to the oh shit factor. It's movies like this that make me utterly disappointed that practical effects are not more recognized during the awards time as much as CGI. And also movies like this are too low-key for it to be noticed for achievement in makeup. And even more so that's going to be overlooked is the performance of our Abigail character by Alicia Weir, that I will be praising for the rest of the year on her memorable performance. Abigail is a movie that shows what true balance and excellent pacing is. Some may see this movie as just another horror movie, there for mere entertainment. But for me, I saw much more than that. It's a complete chemistry-driven story that knows exactly what it is, but it doesn't settle for just knowing what it is. It takes it to the next level to ensure that fans and viewers do not feel that it's just another vampire bloodfest. Abigail has characters we love to follow and has visual effects and makeup that is completely unsettling. And most importantly, during the hour and 50 minute runtime, it always ensures that we are smiling, laughing, or uttering the words, "Oh shit." Abigail is no horror masterpiece and it's not on the same level as The First Omen, and it doesn't try to be. It knows what it wants to do, which is double check every box to entertain and become a memorable entry into this genre that made me wanting more when the credits rolled. I'm giving Abigail a very surprising 3.5 stars.
Let's all go to the lobby. Let's all go to the lobby.
Now, before we get into the rest of the show, make sure you check out my reviews for movies that just became available to rent, buy, or stream now.
Now available on video cassette.
One Small Ember Can Burn Down Everything in Monkey Man, which made me go bananas, receiving 3.5 stars. An Unexpected Encounter, An Unlikely Bond, An Unforgettable Adventure in A Man and His Dog Story in Arthur the King, which made me roll over with emotion, receiving 3 stars. All right, no more animal jokes. Moving on. Long Live the Fighters in Dune Part 2 that kept me in the theater for almost 4 hours until I gave it 3 stars. Sydney Sweeney goes from a good comedy in Bikini in Anyone But You to a bad thriller in a nun uniform in Immaculate that really needed a director to exercise it, receiving 1.5 stars. Jack Black is back as Poe as he faces a new threat. Just a threat without any of the fun. And Skadoosh, it's a lazy cash grab in Kung Fu Panda 4 that received 1.5 stars. A true story of a hairdresser that rallies a community to help a widowed father save the life of a child in Ordinary Angels that made me shed a tear and cheer, receiving 3 stars. And finally, meet Jauncey. He's not imaginary and he's not your friend. And he is the main imaginary character of a horrible movie in Imaginary, which received 1.5 stars. Now, before I get into the rest of the show, make sure you check out this week's episode of the Cultworthy Cinema Podcast and the Movie Wire's new crossover show, Back to the Balcony, as we tackle the 1994 chaotic film, Radioland Murders, and the Siskel and Ebert reviews that followed. The link to that show will be in the description of this episode. And before we jump into the last set of reviews, there is a podcast I want to shout out. It's one of my weekly listening routines, and it's with my favorite Wilson family over at the Super Familiar with the Wilsons. Let's hear from the Wilsons now.
The Super Familiar with the Wilsons podcast. You know that family whose house you hung out in when you were a kid? The house was a little loud and chaotic, but always fun, and sometimes felt more home than home. Well, that's us.
We're the Wilsons, and we welcome you into our podcast with silly chat, ridiculous games, and interviews with interesting people.
Like a spin doctor. The Super Familiar with the Wilsons podcast.
Welcome home.
The British military recruits a small group of highly skilled soldiers to strike against German forces behind enemy lines in World War II in the new Guy Ritchie film, The Ministry of Ungentlemanly Warfare.
Gus March Phillips, I have a mission I want you to lead. Thank you, Sergeant.
What's the plan?
To neutralize the German U-boats in the North Atlantic.
We're losing the war. Hitler is not playing by the rules, so neither are we.
We both know that I'm not very popular with the administration.
The reason they find you unattractive is the very reason I find you attractive.
If I'm to do this, I'll need my own team. You won't like them. They're all...
No!
Mad.
They'll need to be.
This is an unsanctioned, unauthorized mission. If we fail, England will be condemned to a lifetime under the German boot.
And so I said, that is not a dog. That is my wife!
Very good.
You and your operation are reckless.
Abort this mission now.
Hello, can't hear you. Please do off.
You know, there's something to be said about attending a film from a director that I personally have a tradition with, that every time the theater lights go down, I cross my fingers to see what Guy Ritchie I'm going to get, which isn't as bad as my tradition of saying a prayer and making the sign of a cross across my person as I do with Michael Bay films. But say what you want about Guy Ritchie films, love them, hate them, or you feel anytime you buy a ticket, you have about a 50-50 shot of what Ritchie you're going to get. That's at least my ratio. But regardless of the story he tells in recent years, is the amount of subconscious fun he puts in the way he tells a story. Well, at least in every other movie. For example, we go from the Gentleman Fund to the Wrath of Men series to the Operation Fortune Fund to the Covenant series and now the Ministry of Ungentlemanly Warfare. Ritchie tends to go to serious storytelling to almost a mental break to goofy action comedy. I think his 2019 Disney live action remake of Aladdin may have awoken something in Ritchie or given him more of a split personality, but part of the more recent fun in watching a Guy Ritchie movie, but I guess that is part of the fun, is really going in and gambling on Guy Ritchie to see what kind of movie he's going to bring to the table. This picture's writers follow the same reputation as Guy Ritchie, from writer Paul Tamsey that would do a decade of just writing two Air Bud movies to write 2010's The Fighter and 2016's Finest Hours and Patriot's Day. Along with Tamsey, we also have co-writer of Patriot's Day and The Fighter, Eric Johnson. The movie going into it did make me curious, especially with this trio of writers, with not a ton of experience and only one of the writers, Paul Tamsy, that has any sort of comedic experience, if you include the two Air Bud movies he's written. And as we're talking about Air Bud movies, just kind of a side note and an FYI, Spooky Buddies is the best Air Bud sequel, in case you're dying for my opinion on that. But my point is, given the experience of these writers, it did spark some curiosity on what kind of film we were gonna get. Now, let's just call this movie for what it is. The main reason people are gonna buy tickets to this movie are for two key reasons. One, to watch Nazis get killed, and two, to watch Nazis get killed in humorous ways that involve funny lines. Now, if we boil this movie down to just that, and that's where the viewer's expectations lie, then this movie is a mission accomplished. You will enjoy this movie. It's 2 hours of just that. I was on board for that too. There's nothing that makes me more joyous than seeing Nazis get killed in humorous ways. But when it comes to the third act, where we have one of our undercover players, Marjorie Stewart, played by Isaac Gonzalez, who is at a party singing a rendition of Mack the Knife. This song is playing as our crew of undercover Nazi killers, Gus, Anders, Jeffrey, Henry, Freddy, played by Henry Cavill, Alan Richardson, Alan Pfeiffer, Hero Fiennes, Tiffin, and Henry Godling, are fulfilling their final mission. This scene was a lot of fun. It reminded me of films past that use music to symbolize our hero's actions. Holding out for a hero I've always used as an example for this in countless films. But as the music was playing, and though a good scene, it's not a great scene, because at this moment, I realized that the movie could have been so much more. After the music stopped, I pondered why I had this feeling of disappointment, and it came to me as Isaac Gonzalez and her partner Heron, played by Bob's Alashamokin, appear once again. We take our main cast of characters that we're supposed to root for, but compared to the rest of the cast, they are what we would call them the muscle of the filmmaking group. These characters are the ones that we cheer on for merely the actions that they're doing, not whether or not we like them or understand them. They beat up Nazis, say their funny line, and that's it. And they are very good at doing that. But when it comes to the rest of the supporting cast, I found myself wanting more from them. They are just too good to be left in the background. Especially Roy Kinnear, who plays Winston Churchill, and Cary Elwes, who plays Gubbins. Guy Ritchie must have Elwes on a speed dial for any character that deems generic, because Elwes takes these generic characters and embraces the generic character to let the viewer know it's generic. Cary Elwes' screen presence is the poster boy for at least likability of the generic character. And he's so good at it, he really deems his on-screen presence to really take advantage of taking this small role and making it memorable. With such a fantastic cast, a supporting cast, could have gone deeper, and with the realization, this may have made it so our cast of muscle could have been more as well. But I will give credit to Henry Cavill, because there are times I completely forgot it was Henry Cavill. He embraces his character so well, and never overdoes it when it comes to his delivery. When it comes to recent Ritchie movies that go for the fun factor, like The Gentleman and Operation Fortune, The Ministry of Ungentlemanly Warfare is my least favorite. But that's not saying it's not a fun time. Before I came to the third act, I knew what the movie was trying to do, and I was having some fun with it, but the third act plays like a double-edged sword to show me what it really could have been. The Ministry of Ungentlemanly Warfare will entertain as long as you know what you're getting. Nazi killing and one-liners. If your expectations stay here at that level with a timer of 2 hours, you will most likely enjoy this movie while you're watching it. But the third act gives a hint of something that should have been, and it took the experience of just watching mindless action away from me. But if you're feeling down, there is nothing like a good Nazi killing action comedy. And for that, I'm giving The Ministry of Ungentlemanly Warfare 2.5 stars. After raising an unnerving, talented spider in secret, 12-year-old Charlotte must face the facts about her pet and fight for her family's survival when the once charming creature rapidly transforms into a giant flesh-eating monster in Sting.
You called about the noises in your walls, right?
Oh, no, not me.
You sure about that?
Hey there, little guy.
Charlotte!
I need you to watch Liam.
Why?
Because he's 6 months old and he eats paper.
Every time I try and connect, she takes 2 steps back.
Night, Ethan. You hungry?
cool. We're gonna call you Sting.
Hi, Eric.
Could a spider grow twice as big in a couple of hours?
No, that is a physiological impossibility. Sweet Jesus, what the hell happened to it?
Rats.
I don't think a rat's gonna do that.
Spiders only know two things. Eat and kill.
What kind of spider are we talking about here?
A big one.
A spider bite will paralyze its prey because it likes to feed on living flesh.
We have to deal with this together.
What the hell?
It stinks.
That's your spider?
Written and directed by Kaya Roach Turner, the director of a couple fun, low budget guilty pleasures of mine, Necrotronic and Wormwood, comes the biggest budget movie to date for him. Now, whenever these creature pictures come out, even though 90% of the time they fail me, there is always a level of excitement I have going into one of these movies. I get taken back to creature movies of the 90s and early 2000s where studios and writers have some fun with the material. I can almost say my excitement is actually more of an internal hope that what I'm about to view will be my lost feeling of cinematic fun that I had with these movies from the past. While watching the first half of Sting, I had to keep reminding myself that this isn't a reboot of Arachnophobia. The style, the shots, the inclusion of borderline goofy fun are captured by our director, Kia Roach-Turner. The directorial style is present to promote some creature fun, but as the movie progresses, it starts to forget what it is, and it switches the tone and the feel of what we got that was a solid beginning and a solid first half. Now, Sting has everything you would want to create a fun creature feature if you kind of just half pay attention and glance at it on the surface. This is the perfect film to have while you're half paying attention while you're on your phone sitting on the couch. Because when the jump scares or the loud sound effects or music comes on, it signals you to pay attention, almost like an adult clapping their hands towards a child to gain their attention. The characters are not that interesting to really entertain between the main attraction of our spider, even though the performances are decent here, especially from our young spider owner, Charlotte, played by Isla Brown. They just don't really have anything interesting to say or do. The center of all is surrounded by our spider, where what we have in the first half is a mere curiosity of what our writer-director Turner is going to do with the mere premise. But once the curiosity is gone, so was my interest. The second half does throw in almost like a John Goodman type of character we saw in Arachnophobia, as a scientist expert or mainly just comedy relief. Eric, an introverted scientist type played by Danny Kim, who the rest of the building finds weird. And Charlotte's father figure Ethan, played by Ryan Corr, instructs her to stay away from him. But Eric is an important character because his sole purpose is to transition to the second half of the movie, just to see our characters running away from a camera shot for 45 minutes. Turner seems to do the reversal of curiosity or wonder or mystery that so many good horror movies usually utilize. Usually we get point of view shots to promote mystery in the first half to help build suspense. Here, we get the opposite, and it just doesn't work. Now, the main problem I have with Sting here, it does check all the boxes. It does check the technical aspects. It does check the normal characters we see in a movie like this. We do check a creature that we can fear, some good camera shots at times, but Turner never seems to really place all the puzzle pieces together to complete the puzzle of how to make this movie interesting. Now, there are some elements that fans will enjoy. The design of the monster isn't scary, but rather is a neutral in between of not wanting to be scary, but rather just fun and a chaotic symbol. I can appreciate the design and a few scenes of our grown spider as it creates mayhem for our characters in an apartment building, but it just doesn't really stand out as something that's going to stay with me after the runtime. But this is where the movie's true fault is that we have this apartment building, we have these tenants that all know each other, and we add a creature to the mix. There are three things this movie really never taps into to really make this movie memorable or even entertaining. The first is that it never taps into these characters to really make them shine. It never shows a likable chemistry, never gives us enough information to really care about these characters. And next, we have this apartment building that never really takes advantage of creating a secluded environment. Or how is this setting with all these doors and windows that our characters can use to leave? Why do they stay? Why not call the police? If this movie didn't have air vents throughout the building, this movie wouldn't have a single mystery to it. This movie wouldn't have a single creepy moment. It wouldn't have a leg to stand on, let alone eight legs. The next and biggest problem is that it plays it way too safe. It's like they were aiming for a PG rating. Sting maybe needed to separate the director from the writer. Turner obviously had a vision, but her vision is one of counting sheep while they're laying in bed trying to drift off to sleep. There is absolutely no risk-taking to Sting. The only Sting viewers are going to feel is the fact that this was 90 minutes of things we have seen before. We've only seen it better. I recently reviewed a Paw Patrol movie last season, and that movie had me more on the edge of my seat than this film. This was a film that was meant to go to the abyss of streaming that I probably would have clicked past just like many other films. After walking out of Sting, I thought of two movies that attempted this type of giant-sized animal creature feature, and they did it better. One went all in with the fun factor, and the other had a proper balance between fun and suspense. I'll allow you to connect the dots on which one's which, and that was Eight-Legged Freaks and Anaconda. These two films, love them or hate them, they each had a quality or finesse that stood out, and the writers and the filmmakers stuck to their guns on the type of movie they wanted to make. Turner is playing the guessing game here with Sting. Sting checks all the boxes of a standard creature feature element, but then it takes all these elements, it strips them down of all the fun factor, then it shakes up all the technical aspects up in a mixing glass and spews them on the screen, which said and done presents itself as a technically unbalanced mess, with characters I could care less about. And when it comes to the spectacle of the creature the movie is banking on, I simply shrugged my shoulders and said, "So what?" Sting was absent from my memory as soon as I left the theater. It's not bad because it does check all the boxes, but at the same time, it's not good because it checks the boxes. I'm giving Sting 2 stars. That's a cut on this week's edition of The Movie Wire. I want to thank you for listening and thank you for your support. You can also show support by following me on Instagram, Blue Sky, X, Thread, Facebook, TikTok, YouTube, and Letterboxd at Movie Wire Show. And please don't forget to leave a review on Apple Podcasts or Spotify. And if you haven't listened to the cult-worthy cinema podcast of The Movie Wire's team-up show, Back to the Balcony, now is your time. The link to that show will be in the description of this episode. Until next week, do me a favor. Make sure you stay for after the credits of a movie to show the respect to those that put their blood, sweat, and tears into making a feature film, and support your local movie theaters.
A verdict has been made on this episode of The Movie Wire by your host, Justin Hansen. He thanks you for listening to the show. You can follow Justin on Instagram and Twitter at Movie Wire Show, or visit his website, www.themoviewire.com. Oh, and don't forget to leave a review on Apple Podcasts and Spotify. I'm sure he'd love to hear from you. Until next time, we will see you at the movies.
Thank you for bringing me to the movies.